You've heard me say many times, Chicago is the city of tribes. And you wonder why, and other people pick it up too, they say it too. It's not about racial tribes, but there is race in Chicago. And in 1919, I want you to think of the weather and the circumstance. In 1919, black people were being brought up to Chicago with promise of jobs in the stockyards and elsewhere. The Irish had just gotten over the Irish need not apply, and there was still a lot of anti-Irish sentiment because the institutions in Chicago were still the Germanic Protestant institutions of government and LaSalle Street and so forth. Then you had the meatpackers agitating because they wanted to break the unions. And then you had a little fellow in across the ocean who wanted to destroy everything about what we stand for. His name was Karl Marx, and Marxism, and Lenin, and later Stalin. And all of that was boiling together in the Haymarket, in the neighborhoods. People were agitating, and here comes a young man, African-American, on a raft, going from the black part of the beach to the white part of the beach. I guess the water didn't listen to the tribal boundaries, and so the water just took him to the white part, and that's where he was killed. We'll talk to William Lee of the Chicago Tribune on his great story of the 1919 race riots. We'll also talk to Kristen McQuarrie, columnist, the Chicago Tribune, who's just back from Germany. And I don't think she brought me any strudel. We'll see, because she knows I can't eat it. Jeff Carlin is here, my friend and master baker, former goalkeeper. And me, John Cass, husband, father. Notice I always say those two things first, because that's the important thing. Columnist for the Chicago Tribune, nationally syndicated, of course, and also member of the editorial board. Lonely conservative, podcasting behind the Iron Blue Curtain of Illinois. And you know where you are? You're here with us on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
Good afternoon, whatever time it is when people plug into the Chicago Way. And we're so happy to have you here. We're just jumping into the interview right away. Is that okay?
Let's jump in.
All right. So, how was your vacation?
My vacation was excellent. It was a family trip to Germany, and we saw all kinds of World War II monuments, learned even more about World War II, visited the Berlin Wall. Lots of beer and pretzels and fried meat, so you can't go wrong.
Opa, that's a fantastic.
Opa, yeah.
I love it. Your photos were great, but that's not why we called, because Kristen McQuarrie, there have been some political rumblings, and ripples, as John's called it, circling the Madigan camp.
Yeah, so this is really interesting to me. I don't think you can write about it enough, because you have three of his closest associates now in the sights of federal prosecutors. I mean, there's no question when you get a search warrant on someone's home, not that that's a higher standard than a search warrant on a ward office, but that's a very personal thing. And I actually wrote about this a little bit in a column that will appear later, but it reminds me of George Ryan when he was governor. It was just this trickle of various people getting indicted or facing charges. Now, again, none of the Madigan folks were not at that point at all. They just had a search warrant. But it started to get into what they called George Ryan's kitchen cabinet, which were his very close friends, people he vacationed with. And federal prosecutors were able to get them to flip. And that's what eventually ended in 18 felony convictions on corruption charges for the former governor.
Yes, I'm glad you said that we can't write about it enough, because I spent two columns out of four last week writing about it. And And I went to our friend Dan Proft and also Pat Brady, talking to both of them. I said, well, is the Republican Party poised to take advantage of this Madigan tiger hunt? And he said, what Republican Party?
Yeah, it's very true. You would think that given the situation, you have sort of all of these encircling investigations. You have Ed Burke, who's actually been indicted. You have Alderman Kerry Austin, another powerful figure who no indictment, no charges, just a federal raid on her offices. Then you have these three Madigan associates. Let's not forget Governor Pritzker, the feds we know were sort of sniffing around this whole issue with him and his removal of toilets. They were asking for records relating to that. So you would think enough of this would be a daily press release or something from the Illinois Republican Party, and they just seem incapable of being able to capitalize on it. It's pretty strange. I think I've maybe seen one or two press releases just kind of questioning this behavior or that behavior, but I don't see much more than that. I don't know if you have, John.
No, I've seen the Republican Party. They're trying to defend themselves from a rogue posting on one of their Facebook pages that the media is jumping on to paint all Republicans as racists. But that's just typical of us in our business and people who are conservatives. On the other hand, there is advantage to be had. But I don't see, we haven't come to the point where the progressive left, the sort of, I don't know, Ocasio-Cortez's of Illinois, will begin to push, but sooner or later, after Madigan, the tribes will try to take advantage of the power vacuum and take, just like as they did when Harold Washington died, and you know the white guys came in again under the cloud of, or the call of, we will end the angry voices, we will soften the voices. So that's how Daley came in and took over after 20 years, and before him, when Richard J. Daley died, all the groups started fighting, so we'll see. But I don't see any political actors willing, you know, to take that step and be quoted about Madigan yet on the Democratic side. Do you?
No, and you know, it might not happen. I mean, this is someone who has built up so much loyalty over 40 years in, you know, the pinnacle of power, that you might see a situation where he just sort of fades away, almost like Richard M. Daley. You had very close associates of Richard M. Daley, like Bobby Sorich, actually get convicted and imprisoned on corruption charges, but they refused to flip. They really, there are those who will take the fall for their superior.
Remember, Kristen, that Bobby Sorich was, at least he got a pizza party at in the church at Nativity, you know, in the basement for fundraising. And Father Brand compared him to Jesus Christ. He said Jesus had his own legal problems too. I guess so. To further your thought, where are they? Where are these Democrats now?
I think they're, I mean, I don't like to jump on a bandwagon either when you're just looking at, you know, Fed's got permission from a judge to search property. That's all we're at right now. No one has been charged. No one has been accused of wrongdoing. If there are steps taken where you actually see further federal involvement, tapes perhaps, people willing to flip, then you might see the power of Madigan start to erode. But I don't know. It's such a peculiar hierarchy in this state, where I could actually see people like, I mean, nobody really ever heard of Michael McCain before, this lobbyist who lives in the Quad Cities, who's one of Madigan's very close friends and allies in Springfield. I probably interviewed him maybe twice in my entire political covering Springfield history. And it was always just very, very deep background. This is someone who was not well known to the public and really all that much to people outside of Springfield. Is someone like that, I mean, really, when it comes to the feds putting the squeeze on you, you have to choose between your family and your principal, your political principal. Is someone like that willing to flip on someone like Madigan if it came to that? I don't know. I don't know.
And you can clearly tell, though, that Mike Madigan is worried in one way or another, and just based on the 100,000 Club, that story is percolating last week about him ringing the bell for financial aid from those he's helped or those who've helped him. And can you speak a little bit about that?
Legal aid.
Yeah, the legal aid, how that kind of transpired. People may have kind of missed this as it went under the radar.
Yeah, so it's not unusual for members of the House or other Democrats in Illinois to write checks to Mike Madigan's political fund. I mean, he hires the people who go with clipboards and collect signatures, so that's not unusual. And he disperses that money then to other races. What made this unusual is that he made some asks in recent weeks to his campaign fund, which he can spend on legal bills. And the timing is weird because we're not in an election cycle yet. And the dollar amounts were really big. I mean, asking a House rep candidate to write you a check for a House rep who's serving to write a check for $100,000. I mean, that is a big, big ask. I don't think people realize these state reps, you might go around to your neighbors or even the big utility companies, ComEd, whoever, they might write you a check for like $500, $1,000. So by the time you build up a small war chest where you can even write a check for $100,000, that's a lot of blood, sweat, tears, and fundraising. So that made it unusual as well. And yes, an indication that Madigan is aware his legal bills are going to be mounting.
Switching gears, if we may, in the West Suburbs, Peter Roskam lost to Sean Kasten, and now Jeannie Ives is back running against him. What do you think of that?
Interesting, because if she has a power base that's still really strong, that's where it is. The question is that, I mean, the reason I think someone like Sean Kasten won, like many Democrats in the suburbs, had much more to do with just, you know, vitriolic feelings about Trump. So Jeannie Ives can come out and try to differentiate herself policy-wise, talk about the way that Sean Kasten has voted, made sure voters think that he's too left for that seat. But if we have another wave of anti-Trump sentiment sweep across this country and across this state, none of that will really matter. So I think we need to just, I'm not sure that Sean Kasten is maybe as vulnerable as people think. I mean,
and wasn't that was the problem with Roskam? I mean, that's one of the things he faced, is that he was painted as being too close to Trump, and obviously he was as a surrogate for him in the campaign. But it now, how is she going to run where she was kind of painted in that, like you said, in that too close to Trumpism? It's not like she's coming from the other side of it, like she's more of a centrist. It's going to be a tough putt for her based on her previous performances here in the state, obviously running for governor.
Right. I mean, I think Peter Roskam was probably more in line ideologically with voters in that district. I mean, he was someone who, he wasn't out there like beating the drum for Trump. He's in some ways, a conservative Republican, but not like a chest beater. He helped write the huge tax cut. I mean, he was sort of a policy wonk guy who I thought actually was going to be safe that time around. I knew it was going to be close, but I thought he would still squeak by. So if it's just another election of really, really high turnout for the Democrats and a lot of anti-Trump sentiment, I think it's going to be a tougher race for Jeannie Ives than it otherwise would be.
It is clear, Kristen, that the Democrats will tie Trump around her neck and with heavy rope. But it's also clear that the media, of which we are a part, all three of us, is eager as well to tie Trump around her neck and also to damn him as a racist every time he opens his mouth. I wonder, how do people react to that in the privacy of their own homes? Do they see a double standard being set where Ted Kennedy can talk about, you know, Justice Bork will stop black people from going to lunch counters, and Joe Biden can say Romney will put you all back in chains when Romney was portrayed as a racist?
And look at their budget and what they're proposing. Romney wants to let he said in the first 100 days, he's going to let the big banks once again write their own rules. Unchain Wall Street. They're going to put you all back in chains.
I just wonder how people process all that.
You know, I think Trump was making some gains in that area. I mean, he certainly, his base and even others who aren't huge Trump supporters still recognize the double standard that he has faced from the beginning, from the media. But then he ruins whatever little tidal wave of support he might sort of be getting by being too controversial and exploding on Twitter. And it would take just another episode like that, like the latest, where he told, where he said, where now he's saying leave the country, but where he took four members of Congress and said, go back. It would take just something like that in the weeks leading up to November to make it very, very difficult for even existing Republicans and challengers like Jeannie Ives to win.
And right now, I think it's about shaming those who might even... The use of shame by the left it's always been intriguing to me. It's just exactly like the use of shame by the Republicans in the 50s when it was the communist scare. Are you a commie? Are you a commie? And it would terrify people. If you were branded a commie, you were done. And now the same kind of dynamic is being used again on the other side. I just wonder if the people who are, if there is such a thing, people who are, you know, managers of our culture, understand that they're playing intramural politics for short-term gain, but long-term gain, how do you manage a country? Let's say Trump is defeated and all 60 million of his supporters in 2016 are marginalized, as I read. If you support Trump, you're a racist, so that means 60 million people are racists. How does that play out over time? I don't think it's good for the country, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they should all be put into boxcars and sent to some...
Maybe a basket of full of them? Called the basket
yeah,
of
re-education camps or something. What do you think?
The pendulum has obviously swung too far, and you were and you are, I think, getting to a point, even among... more independent voters, where the thought police and what's happening on college campuses and the intolerance of the left is on display every single day, sometimes all day, every hour of every day. Again, Trump hurts that movement, and like I think we wrote in an editorial, he makes it hard for people to defend him and even get past the things that he's done right and defend his policy changes when he just cannot help himself from being inflammatory unnecessarily. I do think that there is a place for civil discourse and that he brings out the worst in people on both sides. And so at the end of the day, it still comes back to him and his behavior as president. He's hurting himself. He's hurting the movement. I'm just not seeing right now that history is going to look back on this and think that people were necessarily overreacting. Not right now, because he can't help himself. The chance at the rally of send them back, I mean, that's really ugly. And at this moment, I don't see that you're ever going to be able to kind of twist that into a good light.
He's personalized politics, but politics was personalized before him by Saul Alinsky and his followers, two of whom were Hillary Clinton, who studied him, and Barack Obama, who used his tactics, and others, although quite neatly and sweetly. It backfired on Hillary with the basket of deplorables, but I tend to agree with you that it's become so untenable in terms of the dialogue and the media reaction to the dialogue, even though we acknowledge most of the media is on the left, that there's no winning strategy that he can he can't continue inflaming people this way.
No, and he has so much other ammunition he could use. He can use some of these members of Congress, their own words against him. I mean, we had Representative Omar talk about what drives pro-Israeli policy in Congress as being all about the Benjamins. I mean, we have some sort of ugly rhetoric from that side, too. He could focus on that. He could let the Democrats fight amongst themselves. I mean, you had Nancy Pelosi and this group on opposite sides of the spectrum recently, but then Trump inserts himself and unites them. So until he can sort of tone down his own worst impulses, I think we could see another year of just another Republican wave across the country, or defeat across the country.
Yeah, I do have to leave it there, Kristen. Thank you as always. Next time we get you in studio, we'll talk some summer recipes and veggie burgers. I've been working on them.
Oh, excellent. I know. We have to get John to try some of these veggie burger recipes.
Yeah, and have Tom Bevin with us. Yes,
absolutely. Yeah, right. Absolutely. But
okay.
Until then, Kristen, thank you as always.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Kristen.
See you later.
All right, we're now joined by my friend and colleague, and I'm proud to call him a colleague and friend, William Lee of the Chicago Tribune, whose recent magnificent story in the Chicago Tribune on the 1919 race riots. Will, that was just fantastic. It was just
fantastic. Thank you, sir.
Fantastic.
I appreciate it, man.
So take us to that scene when it happens. As a child of the South Side, I'm born at 52nd and Peoria Street, 1956, and it's still in the memory of people at that time. There was a tension between African Americans and whites. A lot of it had to do with jobs in the stockyards. People were coming up. The sausage barons were hiring African Americans on the killing grounds, and the Irish and others were upset that they were losing jobs, and there was so much tension. And then you had the Bolsheviks, not Bernie, but others, the real ones from the Russian Revolution. So it was all crazy. And then what happened on that summer in 1919?
Well, it's just like you describe it, all these things kind of tensing up. And you had, even just before then, you also had a lot of the, the Irish athletic clubs kind of started menacing a lot of the citizens, because you have a lot of black residents who are just filling up, thousands really arriving each month. And they started to overflow the black neighborhoods. So the Irish kids start, pushing back with some, political backing. And we come to that Sunday, that hot Sunday on July 27th, 100 years ago. It's about 96 degrees and everyone is at the lake. There's an unofficial boundary between what you call the Black Lake and the White Lake at 29th Street and 31st Street. And Eugene Williams, who's 17 years old, who's down there with about three other friends, he's in the water and he drifts over into what you would consider at that time the white beach. And some of the bystanders took immediate offense to it and started throwing rocks at him. And it just kind of went from there.
And it was one of those things where it wasn't the death of or the injury of this one boy who really the cause. The cause was everything else that you just described. The numbers of blacks moving in, trying to flee the Jim Crow South, was ballooning at a very powerful rate, and there was nowhere for them to go. They were given this bill of ideas that said, "Go to Chicago, go north, leave the South, go for it. We don't want you here. You go where you want to go." And they thought it was going to be this great thing, and when they get here, it turns out it's nothing of the sort.
Well, that's the crazy thing about it, Jeff, because you also have we didn't have really a lot of rules. Like, we had things that were informally done at that time. So a lot of people came to Chicago. It wasn't just the unskilled laborers, but if you were a professional black person with a medical career or anything, a degree or anything, you came here because this was a place to come. And in those early days, you really didn't know. There were no rules, so people could just do anything. I was reading the reports from 1922 that came after the riots, and they said there were a lot of black people all over the city outside of the Black Belt who, up until the riots, were actually having a pretty decent relationship. You know, you had black people as far as Morgan Park. They were living there once it was annexed, and they had very friendly relations. You had folks that were in, you know, far out south, far on the west side. And at the time, you know, some people, they would know to treat, you know, rural black people poorly. But they say, well, how are we supposed to treat these black people with degrees, these black people who set up shops in our neighborhoods? And most of the time it was fine. What the riots really did was kind of show that you can just treat, after that, you could treat any black person, no matter of station in life, poorly, just because that was just what the rules were.
I know that many of my friends on the left will be listening to me very carefully, so I have to tell you, at that time, just a few years before, and I'm talking about 10 years before, my grandfather came to Chicago, and they didn't let Greeks sleep inside. It was the time when Greeks had to sleep in the barn. Okay? So there was a time when, and then you had the Irish hadn't really formed their political machine yet, right? Well, it was still a German town, and so the Irish street gangs, the Hamburgs, the Reagan Colts,
the Alleywood stuff, all of those folks. They formed very quickly, though. What you have to say about, give it to the Irish folks here at that time, is that their groups, Frank Reagan and all that stuff, the political groups led to the gangs because that's where their power was. And they were stronger than, once they were formed, they were very, very, very active. And because of that, ironically, and I learned that, because of their being formed, the black organizations had to form very quickly to respond to it, because they were having their tails handed to them all the time. Families are getting scared and all of that. So then the black street gangs came after that just to kind of match them.
So how many people died in that?
So officially there were 38 African-Americans who died and 15 whites that died. And you had about 523 injured, most of them black of course. But there was always rumors of many, many more deaths on both sides. Black people were told that there were, you know, bodies, hundreds of bodies being dumped in the Bubbly Creek over in Bridgeport and Canaryville. And white people were being told that gangs of black people were, you know, broke into an armory and stole, you know, heavy guns and were raping white women and do all these things. So you're feeding both of these sides these terrible things of each other and kind of letting it kind of settle out in the dust.
After the young man was killed, what was the black response? Because one thing I wanted to know is, you know, the white gangs, they kill this black kid. Black people are enraged. What is the violent response coming from? I'm trying to put in my mind, here you have the black kid killed, right? The cops basically helping the white guys in terms of the killing of the black guy. And then what's the response?
What's your response? Right. Sure. So it's a very strange thing, because at the beach when this is all happening, and let's be very clear, I had a historian spell this out for me. He says even at that beach at that time, you did have both black and white people at the beach who were trying to save Eugene before he finally sank under the waves. But you started seeing this real anger and heat. You have a lot of people there starting the tension is building because the officer won't arrest the man who they say was throwing the rocks and maybe hit Eugene. So you start to get the people actually chase a couple of the officers off the scene because it was starting to get that angry. But you had that moment there, and then you also had some of the Irish gang saying, well, let's keep this going. Let's not let this fade down. Let's not, you know, all this anger, this hate, and all the heat, obviously. Let's just keep this going. So pretty soon you had, it went from that angry scene at the beach to black people start getting attacked downtown and all of that. So from that response, when black people were attacked on streetcars, you had finally the pot boiling over, and then you had the black groups starting to tackle white people and revenge.
What did they do?
Oh, they
in revenge.
They attack. They set up on any sort of solitary white person they can find, if they could find, just as they had, you know, as the white gangs had done to them. And it was just back and forth. But in retaliation, the cops stopped, of course, the black gangs from roaming, you know, taking their weapons. But for the next, you know, 7 days, the next 6 days, you had gangs, white gangs were allowed to kind of run roughshod over them, only until the very end when the, you know, the militia came in and with the man with the bayonets who told you when they told you to get, you better get, you know.
And Will, in your reporting, you did some great stuff. Just kind of walk us through. You talked to a woman who bared firsthand witness only being in Chicago, what, a day or two, a few days? I mean, now in 107, but saw this and the craziness of this firsthand.
Yeah, it was crazy. We had Juanita Mitchell, who was there, 107, one of the only last survivors we could find, who, as you stated, her family, her father died in their Louisiana, and her aunt and uncle up here, who were professionals and who had a business, said, hey, why don't you come up here? We'll take care of you. Chicago's the place to be. And it was.
I'll never forget. My sister and I jumped up and hid behind the piano. My uncle pulled out the biggest gun I've ever seen and stood in the window. And I heard him say, here they come. And it meant that the white folks were coming down 35th Street and the riot was going to begin.
They got here expecting, you know, I think something like Disneyland. You know, it's a major city. You have all these people, you have all these things. They expected something grand. And then not that long after they arrived, that's when it happened. She spent the entirety of the riots tracked up, cooped up inside of an apartment, you know, with her only, you know, sort of window to the world being in the literal window, watching the militiamen come and go. It is a sad thing, but it's, you know, here she is telling it to anybody who will listen to it.
You know, I still don't understand social media. When it was first published, I hesitated to like it because I didn't want to like what happened to all the people, you know?
No, I think the weird thing about it, John, was working on this story, going through all the documents and doing the research, and then traveling home through downtown and you know, along my bus route, stopping at several of the points where black people were literally murdered by hundreds of people. And it's so strange to do it in exactly the same time, you know, 100 years ago this month when it was also starting to get hot. You know, all these sort of conditions, everything that's going on in the world, you say, you know, these men are just sitting in restaurants when hundreds of people streamed in and chased them out and then beat them dead in the street with others watching. Even though that was a different time 100 years ago, it wasn't that long ago. It was still horrifying the people who were just downtown walking, storming along Michigan Avenue to see this happen. And just to think about this is, you know, the very same places that these corners and these streets, you know, hold these memories. It's an overwhelming thing sometimes.
One of the things that gets me is I was born back at the, you know, at 52nd and Peoria, back of the yards. And I remember, or now it's called New City. And I remember in 1960, when I was a little boy, 61, the University of Chicago trying to integrate the neighborhood again. And they rented, Saul Alinsky and his crew rented an apartment on Peoria Street, right down the block. And people gathered. They put a black couple in there, and the neighborhood gathered. They were screaming and fighting and gnashing of teeth. And I was just a little kid, you know. I didn't know. I didn't know anything about the riots. I didn't know that that these have residual effects that shape the way shape the politics and the, I guess, borderlines and the viaduct culture of Chicago for so many years afterward, Will.
Well, that's exactly it, John. I mean, right after all this stuff happened, you know, of course, the race commission, they came up to try to solve all this. They came up with a bunch of recommendations about, you know, increasing schools and doing all the things that they're talking about now, you know, access increasing and all these sorts of things. But what you had was you also had people and then the property owners and, you know, regular people who were a part of the community who were like, no, we don't want this. And the sort of segregation that you've seen erupt since then, it didn't happen, you know, because just because no one acted. It happened because people acted. It happened because people didn't want, in Kenwood, they didn't want the African-Americans coming in and sitting in that particular neighborhood, which is supposed to be so well-to-do, you know. So you had the same people still in Bridgeport, in Canaryville, in Back of the Yards, or New City, as they call it, who didn't want folks, so they started erecting these things. You had, you know, black people in Fuller Park who, once the expressways went up, they were trapped on the other side with these, you know, white folks who really didn't want them. And it's, I don't know if you've been to Fuller Park lately, but it's a really strange place. Myself and the photographer who worked on this, Jason Wambians, we're going there. He went there to take photos, and it's just, the only way I can really explain it to you, John and Jeff, is that it's kind of like a place where time stood still. It's like a bunch of places that are just sort of, they look like they did, you know, 50, 60 years ago, the black residents there. It's a lot of storefront churches. It's a place where it looks like it's not attached to the rest of the South Side or the rest of the black community. It's those things, these events from long ago, they do have psychic damage going forward. And I think that's kind of what, if I could have written 1,000 pages on this, I would have. I had to settle on the 1,200, 2,100 they let me.
and not to spoil it, but one of the closing takeaways in your piece, which is a great observation, is that there was no consensus over who really started then, who was the biggest knucklehead throwing rocks. Obviously, we know relatively the races of those involved, but the biggest takeaway, or the consensus of everybody on both sides, was that the solution to this problem to keep this from happening again was segregation. I mean, that was seemingly what everyone said. Oh, well, you know, we don't want them, they don't want us, let's just, you know, segregate. And like you said, it echoes all over the city today and is exactly the problem, or the root of all the problems we see.
That's exactly it. Everyone said, well, you know, everybody hates the other side, even though no one could go prior to the riots and said that, you know, we did have instances where people got along and lived in close proximity and they didn't hate each other. You know, you had that, but after the riot happened, it repainted everything. It repainted the city as if it had always been so, you know, racist. And to be clear, this is Chicago. It's always had that sort of race, has always been kind of at the center of everything from the time of DuSable on. But even in that, people are still able to, you know, get along and, you know, sort of live together. And as long as there's nothing, you know, really kind of to push them or make them fight, they can handle it. But as you mentioned, people start saying, hey, let's separate everybody. Let's kind of make it easier on everybody. Let's build up the black, you know, neighborhood so they can do it and we'll build up the white. But it, as we saw, it just couldn't last. Eventually, it was all going to all the walls that were erected had to come down.
You might say that, you know, I know that on the southeast side, in near the steel mills, blacks and whites lived together and worked together. But there were tensions because black people were brought up as strike breakers from, you know, the big industrialists wanted to do that. And that's where a lot of the tension comes. It comes also from the unions on the other side, the forming, getting stronger, keeping black people out of the unions, the construction trades and other unions kept them out. These are the residuals of 1919, I think.
Well, also that strike breaking, which would also naturally set up tension, but you also had the sort of that feeling that, you know, black people were turning red. You know, black people who had just fought in the war on their side were somehow now seen as, you know, they're going to the commies. You know, probably many African Americans at that time wouldn't know a commie if they had seen one, you know, right in front of them, unless they were wearing one of those giant, you know, Russian wool hats or whatever. But they wouldn't know, but somehow they were being, you know, attached to this.
Well, the commies knew who they were. The commies knew who they were, and they were part of, they were the fathers of Saul Alinsky, trying to organize people for their own, you know, using, preying on tribal and other, and I don't mean tribal, you know, I know somebody's going to say tribe, I mean white people are tribes too, these divisions in order to get a political outcome. And I see much of that happening today where, you know, there's a news organizations and commentators are damning Trump for what he said about sending them back. the four Congress people, but we don't give credit where it's due to the left, which has basically caused us to think not of individuals, but of groups constantly, over and over and over again. And so I don't solution to you.
Well, I take the tact of this, John. It has always been from the beginning, because, like I said, black people have been painted as red for a long time. If black people are so susceptible to the reds, at some point the people have to, you know, the government has to start saying, well, maybe what are we doing that is maybe pushing them to that? Don't say that we're just going there because these strangers. What could the country do to prevent that sort of sentiment from catching the ear of black people?
Bingo.
That's the thing. That's something they got to figure it out.
If I were the editor of the Tribune, I would authorize you to do a 10-part series with colleagues who I'll name later on the effect of Democratic machine politics and social engineering on the black family and in Chicago, and how wonderful it was that they basically helped the government help destroy an entire people. But that's for another talk.
Well, if you're going to first ask me if you have their ear, why don't you tell them to give me a raise first, and then we can start talking about processes.
Exactly. That's 100%.
Will Lee, another excellent piece. Check him out, Benoit Cowboy. Of course, check out his live tweeting on the weekends of Bond Quarter. What are you doing weekends? Or are you doing Fridays? I forgot what you're.
No, I did Sunday. I just did yesterday. Go to your Twitter and check out all the crazy cases.
Thanks, Will. You're awesome. Thank you, sir.
Sure.
Once again, thanks to William Lee, reporter at the Chicago Tribune, my friend and colleague and former leg man, actually, on a great piece on the 1919 race riots in Chicago, and also Kristen McQuarrie, the spiritual sister of the Chicago Way, member of the editorial board of the Tribune, and columnist in her own right. Thanks for joining us. And Jeff Carlin, WGN producer, Rocon Show with Anna DeVellantis. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, columnist of the Chicago Tribune, and member of its editorial board. Remember, I love reading the reviews that I see on iTunes. You guys can't tell you enough how important that is to me and Jeff, or Jeff and me, whatever the grammar is. Jan Carlin will correct me on Facebook, I'm sure, because it is important. So tell your friends about this, and not only the guys at the cigar store too, because I know you're listening. You know, tell your friends, write a review. It's important because here we are, podcasting behind the iron blue curtain of Illinois. See you next week.